Attention listeners, join us at the Shine Music Fest on Saturday, August 24th. Look forward to lots of fun and interactive experiences, including a live recording of the Blind Chick podcast. Learn more and RSVP at www.shinemusicfest.com/event-info.
Welcome. You are listening to the Audio Information Network of Colorado. This recording is intended to be used solely by individuals with barriers to print.
Thank you for joining us for the February 6th Sunday reading of the Denver Post. My name is Diane Adler. Today we will be reading the following main articles. Diversity, who gets to ski? Industry examines efforts to include wider range of people by Allison Kruger. National security, looking for evidence? Trust us, Biden administration says, by Chris McGarian. Immigration is driving U.S. population growth, by Miriam Jordan and Robert Gabeloff. Marshall Fire Cleanup. County urged to be careful. Ex-FEMA chief. Experts warn contracting mistakes can jeopardize millions in federal funds. By Noel Phillips. And following up with miscellaneous articles. Diversity. Who gets to ski? Industry examines efforts to include wider range of people. By Allison Kruger, the New York Times Company. When Tim Pham learned to ski in the 1980s, the sport seemed simpler. He would go to quiet resorts in Northern California like Sugar Bowl, where he would show up any time of day, buy a $35 lift pass, and ski without facing lines or crowds. I could just decide I wanted a lesson and go up to the window and ask for one, Pham said. There were no reservations needed or long lines. He didn't even have the right gear. I skied in jeans and rented skis, he said. The boots never fit right, but we didn't care. Afterward, he would head to the lodge, where there was live music and domestic beer on tap for $2. I miss those days, said Pham, 50, who now lives in San Jose, California, and works in corporate wellness. Now, he said, everything is more of a hassle. In 2017, his local mountain, Palisades Tahoe, became part of Alterra Mountain Company, a skiing conglomerate that owns prestigious properties across the country, including Deer Valley in Park City, Utah. Since 2018, the company has sold an Icon Pass, which, at various prices, offers admission to its 47 mountain destinations all season long. The result? More skiers. I used to be able to get to the mountain in the afternoon and ski half the day. Now, if you don't get to the resort by 7:30 a.m., you can't find parking, Pham said. Now, on weekends and holidays, there are lines everywhere. Don't get him started on prices. It costs $200 to ski today if you don't have a season pass. For most people, if you make $20 an hour, that's 10 hours of work, right? He said. And beer is 5 times more expensive. It's all very fancy, and you have to wait in line for drinks. Who wants to wait in line when you've been skiing all day? Pham doesn't want to keep anyone from skiing, but he himself is discouraged. I think people should be able to have access to the mountain, especially if they pay for a pass, he said. But the resorts need to step up and make changes. We can't have these crowds anymore. Crowded. The crowds at ski resorts have heated up long simmering tensions about how much diversity the sport can have and what kind of efforts should be made to get a wider range of people on the mountain. People say, the mountain is too crowded. We don't want any new people here. Go home, tourists. You aren't a real skier, said Kirsten Lynch, the CEO of Vail Resorts, which owns 36 properties in the United States. Her company sold its season pass, the Epic Pass, at a discount this year. The full pass was marked down to $783 from $979, and the local pass went to $583 from $729. Sales rose 40%. Vail Resorts said that over the holidays, the busiest time of year, 90% of lift lines were under 10 minutes, and that overall visits to the resorts are down year over year, as reported in January. But across the country, there are indeed more skiers. Last season, we saw a record number of participants, said Adrienne Saya-Isaac, the Director of Marketing and Communications for the National Ski Areas Association, a trade group, which estimated that more than 1 million new skiers and snowboarders hit the slopes. In the past 5 years, many luxury ski resorts have been consolidated under conglomerates such as Vail Resorts and Alterra Mountain Company, which has in some ways increased access. It used to be really cost prohibitive to go to these resorts, said Constance Beverly, the CEO of Share Winter Foundation, a nonprofit that creates opportunities for youths historically denied access to skiing and snowboarding. Now, budget airlines and season passes that grant admissions to multiple resorts have made it possible for more people to ski recreationally around the country. But the crowds have left some skiers feeling wistful. CJ Knight was in middle school when his family moved to Crested Butte. He and his buddies would hit the slopes almost daily and face almost no lines. Then, in 2018, Vail Resorts bought his local mountain. There are days I watch the webcam and say, I don't want to go out at all because the lines are too long, said CJ, now 15. I'm looking at one very long one forming now. Vail Resorts said that the volume of visitors has not changed since it bought Crested Butte Mountain Resort. Now, CJ goes skiing early in the morning, when it's really cold, or later in the day, when most people have already hit the après-ski scene. He also goes backcountry skiing. Of course, everyone has a right to ski, especially if you bought a pass, he said. I just wish that we could have some sort of break from the visitors, a period of time when people don't want to come here. Who then? As mountains become more crowded, skiers and resort owners have asked the question, if not everyone can fit, who should be here? Industry leaders say they need new skiers for their business to survive. This sport is predominantly male and white, and it's been flat in the number of ski visits over the past 20 years, which means it's not growing, Lynch said. In order to grow, we need to engage all demographics. Rusty Gregory, the CEO of Alterra Mountain Company, said, I think it's an obligation for us to diversify. He added that being good stewards of the land means opening it up to all. Skiing has not historically been accessible to black or brown people or those who are economically disadvantaged. There are so many areas of our recreational life that have been segregated, and downhill skiing is one of them, said Daniel Krimkowski, a sociology professor at the University of Vermont, who published a book last year about African-American underrepresentation in fine arts and outdoor recreation. This sport took off in our country after World War II. It was created for affluent white soldiers who experienced it in France and Europe. What is interesting about ski culture is that, in many ways, it builds community by exclusion rather than inclusion, Isaac said. According to data from the National Ski Areas Association, 87.5% of skiers over the 2020-2021 season were white. Black skiers made up 1.5% of the group, and Native Americans 0.7%. Crowded resorts only exacerbate these tensions, said Anthony Kwame Harrison, a professor of sociology and Africana studies at Virginia Tech. I don't think a majority of skiers are racist, he said, but if longtime skiers become frustrated because they are seeing areas being crowded, when you look at that crowd, who do you immediately identify as being most out of place? Ski companies are making different calculations about how to welcome newcomers. At Vail Resorts, the clearest change is the price of its Epic Pass, which has made access slightly more affordable. The company also is focusing on diversity, equity, and inclusion within its company ranks. As of 2021, Alterra has a newly structured legal and social responsibility division, which conducts an audit of its company culture. Vail Resorts has teamed with nonprofits to draw more skiers, especially children, to try skiing at Vail-owned resorts in an initiative called the Epic for Everyone Youth Access Programs. Inclusion. Alterra seems to be in favor of limiting crowds. Its Icon Pass, starting at $729, is considerably more expensive than the Epic Pass. The higher the price, theoretically, the lower the demand, Gregory said. We want to make sure we are offering an experience for people that they want to return to. The company is working with the Share Winter Foundation to bring in newcomers to ski, focusing on days when the mountain is less busy. This isn't a perfect science by any means, Gregory said. Some skiers approve of this approach. I would probably go to one of the Icon Mountains if I had a choice. I like how they are handling things better, said Rebecca Hanrahan, 46, a retired engineer who lives in Edwards. I live closer to the Vail Resorts, so I don't really have a choice. Others are more skeptical. Don't placate and blow smoke and say we are doing all these outreach programs and bringing kids of color to the mountain, said Henry Rivers, the CEO of the National Brotherhood of Skiers, which has 54 clubs across North America that give Black youths access to skiing. Real change comes when you make management inclusive, when presidents of resorts and marketing personnel are people of color. These kids need to see instructors who look like them and who they can bond with, Rivers said. They need to see kids of color getting into the Olympics representing snow sports. Some skiers, such as Michele Oliver, are taking matters into their own hands by helping new skiers become regulars on the mountain. Oliver, a 24-year-old Native American photographer, grew up in Niwot and Berthoud and learned to ski as a little girl. There are not as many Black and Brown and Indigenous people on the slopes as I wish, she said. I remember when I was a little kid, my parents couldn't afford fancy gear, and I had ski pants from Walmart. I remember feeling a lot of pressure even then to look better and cooler. She has made a point of getting friends and family members to the slopes by offering free lessons and, when possible, gear. We help each other get access to whatever we need to ski, said Oliver, who splits her time between Wyoming, Colorado, and Vermont. She recalled helping one friend get comfortable with falling over and getting back up again and battling her fears. I was with her when she was a beginner, and now she is really good and kind of a regular, she said. This is how we can change skiing. National security. Looking for evidence? Trust us, Biden administration says, by Chris Megirian, the Associated Press, Byline, Washington. When President Biden's administration was asked for evidence to back up dramatic claims about national security developments this past week, it demurred with a simple rejoinder. You'll have to trust us on that. No, they would not reveal what led them to say they knew that Russia was plotting a false flag operation as a pretext to invade Ukraine. No, they would not explain their confidence that civilian casualties were caused by a suicide bombing rather than U.S. Special Forces during a raid in Syria. The administration's response took a particularly caustic turn as spokespeople suggested that reporters were buying into foreign propaganda by even asking such questions. The lack of transparency strained depleted reserves of credibility in Washington, a critical resource diminished over the decades by instances of lies, falsehoods, and mistakes on topics from extramarital affairs to the lack of weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. The exchanges were also a sign of increased skepticism of the Biden administration when it comes to intelligence and military matters, particularly after officials failed to anticipate how swiftly the Afghan government would fall to the Taliban last year and initially defended a U.S. missile attack in Kabul as a righteous strike before the Pentagon confirmed the action had killed several civilians, but no terrorists. This administration has made statements in the past that have not been proven accurate, said Kathleen Hall Jamison, director of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. Kabul wasn't secure. The drone strike did kill civilians. The press is doing its job when it asks, how do you know that? The latest scrutiny seemed to have struck a nerve, resulting in barbed interactions with White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki and State Department spokesman Ned Price that stood out even amid the typically contentious relationship between the government and the press. Jameson described the responses, which included insinuations that reporters were being disloyal, as completely inappropriate. These are cases in which the reporter's role is even more consequential because the matters, the use of lethal force by the U.S. military and a potential war in Europe, are so important, she said. The first exchange took place Thursday aboard Air Force One en route to New York as Psaki fielded questions about the U.S. Special Forces raid in Syria, which resulted in the death of Islamic State leader Abu Ibrahim al-Hashimi al-Qurashi. U.S. officials said al-Qurashi killed himself and his family with a suicide bomb, but NPR's Aisha Raskow said there may be people that are skeptical of the events that took place and what happened to the civilians. Psaki asked whether the reporter was suggesting the Islamic State is providing accurate information, as opposed to the U.S. military. I mean, the U.S. has not always been straightforward about what happens with civilians, Raskow responded. Asked about her comments, Psaki said Friday that we welcome tough questions and good faith scrutiny. She said officials were committed to providing as much detail as possible about the Syria raid and that she was relying on firsthand reports from our elite service members to describe the incident. Price similarly sparred with a reporter at the State Department briefing on Thursday after U.S. officials said Russia was preparing a false flag operation as the opening act for an invasion of Ukraine. The alleged scheme included a stage explosion and enlisting actors to portray people mourning the dead. Where is the declassified information? Asked Matthew Lee of the Associated Press. I just delivered it, Price said. No, you made a series of allegations, Lee responded. Price said U.S. officials need to protect sources and methods. After a contentious back and forth, Price said that if reporters want to find solace in information that the Russians are putting out, that is for you to do. He later walked back his comments. Representative Jim Himes, a member of the House Intelligence Committee, said the administration hoped to prevent Russia from following through on a false flag plot by publicly airing the allegations. This really isn't a question of winning over the public, said Himes, a Democrat of Connecticut. This is about altering Vladimir Putin's behavior. Richard Stengel, a former editor of Time magazine and one-time senior State Department official, said the government frequently has to make difficult decisions about balancing sensitive information and the need to be transparent. There's a cost-benefit analysis, he said. That's the judgment they're making every day. But there are long percolating concerns that the scales have tipped too far toward secrecy. Even Biden's Director of National Intelligence, Avril Haines, said the government classifies too much information. In a January 5th letter to Senators Ron Wyden, a Democrat of Oregon, and Jerry Moran, a Republican of Kansas, Haines said deficiencies in the current classification system undermine our national security, as well as critical democratic objectives, by impeding our ability to share information in a timely manner. She added, this erodes the basic trust that our citizens have in their government, especially as the volume of classified material produced continues to grow exponentially. Politicians routinely have promised to restore trust in Washington, but it remains a scarce commodity ever since the Vietnam War and the Watergate scandal. Soon afterward, President Jimmy Carter won office by telling voters, I'll never tell a lie. He was voted out after one term. Scandals have tarnished subsequent administrations, from secretly funding the Contras in Nicaragua by selling weapons to Iran under President Ronald Reagan, to President Bill Clinton covering up an affair with a White House intern. After the terrorist attacks of September 11, 2001, President George W. Bush claimed the U.S. needed to invade Iraq to eliminate Saddam Hussein's weapons of mass destruction. But no such weapons were found, and American troops spent years wrestling with a bloody insurgency. President Donald Trump routinely misrepresented basic facts about his administration throughout his term and continues to spread falsehoods about the last election. Biden promised to restore faith in Washington after defeating Trump, but trust appears to be in short supply 1 year after taking office. Not only did the chaotic withdrawal from Afghanistan undermine his administration's credibility, Americans have grown exasperated with shifting public health guidance during the pandemic. According to a CNN SSRS poll conducted in December, only 34% of Americans said Biden is a leader you can trust. An additional 66% said they have some doubts and reservations. Immigration is driving U.S. population growth, by Miriam Jordan and Robert Gebeloff, The New York Times Company. Overall, 2021 will go down as the year with the slowest population growth in U.S. history. New census data shows why. Both components of growth, gains from immigration and the number of births in excess of the number of deaths, have fallen sharply in recent years. In 2021, the rate of population growth fell to an unprecedented 0.1%. Yet within these sluggish figures, a new pattern is emerging. Immigration, even at reduced levels, is for the first time making up a majority of population growth. In part, this is because Americans are dying at higher rates and having fewer babies, trends accelerated during the pandemic. But it's also because there are signs that immigration is picking up again. Even after 4 years of stringent controls on immigration imposed under former President Donald Trump, the overall share of Americans born in other countries is not only rising, but also coming close to levels that were last seen in the late 19th century. The numbers are not nearly what they once were. The latest report from the Census Bureau's Population Estimates Program showed a net gain of 244,000 new residents from immigration in 2021, a far cry from the middle of the previous decade, when the Bureau regularly attributed annual gains of 1 million or more to immigration. Yet, that drop-off pales in comparison to the slowdown in what demographers call natural increase, the excess of births over deaths. In 2021, that figure was 148,000, or one-tenth the gain that was normal a decade ago, and smaller than international migration for the first time. As of December, immigrants represented 14.1% of the U.S. population, matching the peak of the decades-long immigration boom that began in the 1960s and approached the record 14.8% seen in 1890, shortly before large numbers of Europeans began disembarking from vessels at Ellis Island. The foreign-born population is increasingly concentrated among middle-age groups, with a large number of immigrants having lived in the United States for many years. About 1 in 5 Americans between ages 40 and 64 was born overseas. And 2/3 of foreign-born residents have been in the country more than a decade, the census data shows. In that respect, the country's demographics reflect the long-term effects of the huge levels of immigration it experienced during the 1970s and 1980s. We get so used to being around people who have been here for decades and navigate American society seamlessly that we almost forget they're immigrants, said Tomas Jimenez, a Stanford University professor who researches immigration and assimilation. The recent slowdown in immigration was an apparent result not only of the tougher immigration policies, but also of measures taken in response to the COVID-19 health crisis. In early 2020, the government sealed the borders with Mexico and Canada and limited international entries by air. The closure of U.S. consular offices around the globe derailed visa processing. But the data suggests that tougher restrictions on the border may not have been the biggest factor in the slowdown. Many immigrants decided to leave the country. During the first years of Trump's administration, the number of immigrants coming into the country held steady, while the number leaving increased, figures show. Some data suggests that the pace of immigration has picked up lately. U.S. Customs and Border Protection reported a surge of enforcement activity last year, and the Census Bureau's monthly employment survey also detected an uptick in foreign-born respondents in late 2021. The economic and political circumstances that compel people to leave their home countries have persisted, and demand for foreign workers of all skill levels remains brisk. The newcomers since President Joe Biden took office come from all over the globe, as the government has lifted the cap on refugees, welcomed thousands of families seeking asylum on the southwestern border, and reopened the door to foreign workers on temporary visas. The current labor shortage has heightened calls for foreign workers in fields as varied as restaurant service and nursing to help fill vacancies. Marshall Fire Cleanup, County Urged to Be Careful. Ex-FEMA chief, experts warn contracting mistakes can jeopardize millions in federal funds. By Noelle Phillips, The Denver Post. Faced with clearing the debris of hundreds of homes incinerated by the Marshall Fire, Boulder County is entering a high-stakes world of government contracting, where tens of millions of dollars will be spent in a short time so people can begin rebuilding their lives. The competition between the companies that do this disaster recovery work is fierce. Such projects can be ripe for fraud, and any mistakes Boulder County makes in overseeing its soon-to-be-awarded cleanup contract could leave local taxpayers holding the bill without repayment by the federal government. Already, two companies competing for the contract raised red flags in the days after the December 30th wildfire, warning Boulder County that it was on track to jeopardize millions in federal reimbursements by not following proper procurement procedures. And a former director of the Federal Emergency Management Agency, who lives in Boulder County, said he's concerned about how the county is going about hiring a contractor to clear the mess left by the 6,000-acre wildfire that destroyed 1,270 homes and businesses, a loss of more than $500 million. If an audit is performed by FEMA or the Inspector General and they find they didn't do it the right way, then FEMA has to ask for a part of the money back, and the taxpayers are on the hook to pay it. That's why it's so important to do it the right way, said Michael Brown, who led FEMA under President George W. Bush from 2003 to 2005. Boulder County Attorney Ben Perlman said the county intends to do everything the right way, so the people who lost homes in Louisville, Superior, and parts of unincorporated Boulder County can rebuild their lives. Obviously, there's a tremendous amount of cleanup to be done, and it's a very important contract for us, he said. 11 companies submitted bids to clear fire debris from private property, and the county expects to pick a contractor as early as this week, possibly at Tuesday's county commissioners' meeting. Raising red flags. Last month, two national companies that specialize in disaster recovery sent letters to Perlman to warn him Boulder County would jeopardize federal aid for cleaning up burned houses unless it followed the rules in place for contracts. They urged Boulder County to put the cleanup contract out to bid, something county officials later did, as they said they'd always intended. The project could cost more than $100 million, industry experts say. The federal government typically reimburses 75% of that cost. But last week, Colorado's two Democratic U.S. Senators, Michael Bennett and John Hickenlooper, and U.S. Representative Joe Neguse, a Democrat of Lafayette, wrote FEMA and President Joe Biden to ask that the federal government repay 100% of the contract's cost. The two companies, Cirrus Environmental Services and Ash Britt, raised questions about an existing contract that Boulder County signed in 2017 with a third company to perform debris removal after disasters, according to the letters, which the Denver Post obtained through a Colorado Open Records Act request. Representatives from the two companies declined to comment. Proceeding under this dated, non-compliant procurement contract quite simply puts Boulder County at significant risk of incurring obligations which will not be reimbursed by FEMA, wrote Bernie Boucher, a lawyer for Ireland Stapleton, a Denver firm retained by Cirrus Environmental Services, which is headquartered in Sarasota, Florida. That letter was dated January 13th. Another lawyer, Sarah M. Mercer of Denver-based Brownstein, Hyatt, Farber, and Schreck, on January 8th, wrote to request a meeting with someone in the county attorney's office to talk about the contracting process. Mercer, who represents Ash Britt of Deerfield Beach, Florida, also included a two-page memo outlining problems she found with the county's existing contract and the pricing schedule for debris removal work. On January 18th, the county opened bidding on a Marshall Fire cleanup contract by publishing a request for proposal, or RFP, on the Rocky Mountain e-purchasing system website. The existing contract, signed in 2017 with Galveston, Texas-based DRC Emergency Services, was awarded so Boulder County would have a company on standby to help clean up after natural disasters. But the contract was for jobs that cost less than $500,000, according to public documents. While Ash Britt and Saris feared Boulder County would use that contract to hire DRC for the Marshall Fire recovery, Perlman said that was never the plan. "I can't speak to their concerns, but there never was a time when Boulder County wasn't going to do an RFP and go through the process to get us the right contractors to do this work," Perlman said. A representative of DRC referred questions to a county spokesman. Saris, Ash Britt, and DRC are among the 11 companies that have bid on the Marshall Fire debris removal work, Perlman said. He said he was prohibited from revealing how much the various companies bid to do the work. Since the bids came in, the county's purchasing and public works departments have been analyzing the offers. As late as Thursday, the county was asking the companies for additional information, including sending out a questionnaire so the 11 companies could disclose any past legal troubles. Very specialized work. In the United States, few companies specialize in cleaning up burned buildings, cars, and other debris after a large natural disaster such as a wildfire or a tornado. It's a competitive field where millions of dollars are at stake. And industry observers say the companies play hardball with each other, hiring lawyers, lobbyists, and consultants to help pave the way for lucrative contracts. Those lobbyists and consultants are on the ground in Boulder County. It's complicated work because of the hazardous material exposed by burned construction material and household products that melted in the heat. Most damaged homes will need to be completely razed to eliminate unstable structures and contaminated soil. All of that must be disposed of in approved landfills, and the companies that do the work must account for every load hauled away. Already, Boulder County has collected spoiled food and removed burned vehicles and vegetation from public roads. Curbside collection of items ruined by smoke and wind from homes that weren't destroyed is ongoing. The county used DRC to do some of that work, based on the 2017 contract, said Andrew Barth, a spokesman for Boulder County Public Works. But the big job will be removing the ruins of the burned homes and businesses, where materials from drywall to electronics to furniture to household cleaning products burned, leaving behind toxic waste. Most sites will have asbestos waste that must be hauled to special landfills certified to handle it. Many foundations, retaining walls, and several inches of topsoil will need to be removed. Brown, the former FEMA director who resigned after controversy over the federal government's response to Hurricane Katrina, warns that such cleanup contracts are vulnerable to fraud because local governments are under pressure to help people rebuild their homes as quickly as possible. Debris removal can become, I want to emphasize, I'm not accusing anyone in this situation, but debris removal companies can be less than stellar, said Brown, who currently hosts a morning talk show on Denver's 630 KHOW. For example, companies being paid by the ton in the past have dug out extra soil to increase the weight of their loads, Brown said. That's the kind of fraud that can be committed if someone wants to be unethical about what they are doing, he said. FEMA will want to know that Boulder County followed the correct process and hired a company that doesn't have a checkered past. As FEMA director, Brown said he made calls to governors and mayors to tell them money was being withheld or needed to be repaid because of mistakes. and errors in the cleanup ultimately could slow the recovery for residents who just want to put their lives back together, he said. It's a hardball competitive process, which is why I emphasize the state and the county do this exactly right, Brown said. They have to be certain that the company they hire has a good reputation for doing things right. First in Colorado, Federal Heights makes history. All the members of the city council are women, but they say they just want to represent citizens well. By John Aguilar, The Denver Post. As departing Federal Heights Councilman Harold Thomas said his goodbyes late last year to his colleagues on the city council, he noted that the city is being left in really good hands. But what neither Thomas nor anyone else at the December 7th meeting mentioned was that those hands on the council belong exclusively to women, making this mobile home park-filled working-class city just north of Boulder the first municipality in Colorado's 146-year history to seat an all-female city council. I think it's a great honor, said Mayor Linda Montoya, who said she initially didn't realize her city had reached this historic milestone after the November election. It's awesome. I think it's great. What happened in Federal Heights, a city of nearly 13,000 residents, is not unprecedented nationally. In November, Las Cruces, New Mexico, made headlines when it seated an all-woman council. A year earlier, the same thing occurred in Asheville, North Carolina. But University of Massachusetts political science professor Shannon Jenkins, who specializes in women in politics, said a city council made up entirely of women is a pretty rare event still, although she said it could lead to less confirmation and more cooperation at the local level. Women tend to approach their jobs a little differently, Jenkins said. They tend to focus on coalition building, consensus building, and are less adversarial. The symbolism of having the first all-female city council is important. The male-free arrangement could place greater emphasis on issues that particularly matter to women, such as housing, healthcare, mental health, and safety, said Lisa Calderon, executive director of Emerge Colorado, that helps get women elected to local offices. It presents a tremendous opportunity because city councils are closest to the ground, Calderon said. It's a great opportunity to have an all-woman council be more receptive to the everyday issues people are facing. It's remarkable and should be celebrated. Kevin Bomber, executive director of the Colorado Municipal League, said it's hard to say how the women now leading Federal Heights might differ from an all-male or mixed-gender council. Most issues municipal leaders deal with are as free from gender identity as they are from partisan politics, he said. However, it is undeniable that there is a much greater likelihood of awareness of policy impacts on women when they might exist that you may not get with, say, an all-male council. Colorado, Bomber said, does pretty well when it comes to female representation in positions of power. Women hold a majority of House seats in the General Assembly. And according to a survey released by the Center for American Women in Politics in April 2021, 44.4% of the state's municipal political positions are held by women, which ranks the state third in the nation in that category. Colorado does appreciably better than the nation as a whole, which the Center for American Women in Politics pegged at just 30.5% of all municipal seats held by women. It's common to see women as mayors, currently 14 of 38 in the Denver metro area, and also frequently elected to city council or town board seats, Bomber said. It's been a long time coming. Just 34 years ago, Steamboat Springs became Colorado's first city to seat a majority female council. Julie Green, known in 1988 by her married name Julie Schwal, was one of four women on the seven-person council. Green, now 70, did her best to balance her job and home life with her civic obligations as a councilwoman. She remembers what should have been short trips to the grocery store, turning into marathon conversations with constituents, endlessly frustrating her children. I had young children. They begged me not to do it again, Green said. I did my city council work at night after the kids went to bed. She remembers her time in Steamboat City's council as an extremely friendly experience, where she and her colleagues dealt with typical issues that often confront civic leaders. Whether to allow Walmart into town, and how to increase employment in the ski resort town during the summer. I don't know if priorities would have been different if it had been a male-majority council, Green said. Doris Peterson said women are generally more caring and collaborative in their approach to things, but she sees her job as one of the seven women on the Federal Heights City Council in a more practical light. To me, gender did not matter, said Peterson, who is 81 and moved to a senior mobile home park in the city in 2016 after her husband died. Everyone who became a council member is dedicated to doing what they can do to better their city. Peterson served on Federal Heights Planning and Zoning Commission for 2 years before being convinced by former Mayor Dan Dick, who is a neighbor, to run for a seat on the council. I've almost always been involved in something helpful, she said. Federal Heights' city manager is also a woman. Jacqueline Halbernt said she is glad we can pave the way, but added that there wasn't a coalition of women who ran together. It just turned out that way in Federal Heights. Rather matter-of-factly, she said, reporting to all women in her role as city manager makes no difference to me. I implement what the majority wants, whoever they may be, Halbernt said. Sarah Dawn Perlstein, who moved to the city just 4 years ago, said being on a council with women only breaks that barrier and is a big deal for women, but she said she will keep her focus on the business of Federal Heights. I just want to do a good job for the people, Perlstein said. Need for greater security amid threats. Bill would help to protect Coloradans during worship, by Saja Hindi, The Denver Post. FBI agents arrested a man who made plans to bomb Temple Emmanuel Synagogue in Pueblo in November 2019. Later that month, Denver police arrested a man who witnesses said was pointing a weapon at them at the downtown Denver Islamic Center and shouting anti-Muslim comments. Incidents such as these in Colorado and across the country have forced leaders of religious institutions and community centers to reckon with the security of their spaces, which often are built as large open areas meant to allow access to anyone. The federal government provides money for security enhancements and training through a grant program for nonprofits, including houses of worship, that are considered high risk for terrorist attacks. But the funding is limited. That's why Colorado groups are supporting legislation to provide additional dollars through a state program. In 2021, 51 nonprofits in Colorado applied for more than $6.5 million from the federal program, but only 10 received funding for a total of more than $1.1 million, according to HB 22-1077. Under this bill, lawmakers hope to allocate $1.5 million annually for Colorado nonprofits that were unable to get federal money for security of their institutions. For leaders such as those at Congregation Rodof Shalom in Denver, where more than 300 families attend services at the synagogue, it's been difficult to get the money needed to make the needed security upgrades all at once, said Executive Director Josh Gold. The synagogue has applied for security grants from the federal program for several years, but hasn't received any funding. So staff members are doing the upgrades in stages, something that's been a focus since the 2018 Pittsburgh synagogue shooting at the Tree of Life. Part of those upgrades include installing about 12 cameras in the building, but Gold said an additional 8 to 10 would be beneficial. The synagogue also has a lot of windows in the front of the building, so another project includes adding security measures to the windows to slow someone down if they tried to break in through a window and cause less damage. And staff members want to add bollards in front of the building to slow vehicles that may try to hit the building, as well as a vestibule in the entryways. There's hundreds of congregations of all different faiths in Denver and Colorado, and so for a place like us, where we have membership dues, we can make some of that happen. But for some of the smaller churches especially, they don't necessarily have the same means to money to be able to accomplish that, Gold said. And so if there are funds for them to increase their own security, that's going to be good for everybody. Bill's sponsor, Representative Daphna Michelson-Jeanette, a Commerce City Democrat, said religious institutions and nonprofits are facing issues that should have been put away decades ago. And we need to make sure that people feel comfortable in their places of worship, whomever they worship. My district includes Aurora and the portion of Aurora that is disproportionately targeted for having diverse populations. And we've seen challenges in my Aurora community, Michelson-Jeanette said. I am also a member of the Jewish community, which has been directly targeted in higher numbers than we have seen in a long time. The Anti-Defamation League of the Mountain States region, which is backing the state funding bill, reported that the number of anti-Semitic incidents in Colorado in 2020 reached its second highest level in the past 10 years, with one incident less than the high in 2019. Senior Associate Regional Director Jeremy Shaver said religious institutions are facing more domestic and foreign terror threats, as are other organizations, such as the Colorado NAACP, when a pipe bomb was detonated outside the Colorado Springs building in 2015. Although FBI data shows a decrease in the number of hate crimes occurring at religious institutions in 2020, 8, from 2019, 11, the total number of hate crime incidents reported by Colorado law enforcement agencies increased every year from 2017, 78, to 2020, 281, the latest data available. The FBI's hate crime data catalogs only incidents that are reported to police and that police determine were motivated by bias. Experts repeatedly have said the data is incomplete because it leaves out crimes not reported to law enforcement and relies on investigators' findings, which can vary based on their training and available resources. Advocacy groups such as Stop AAPI Hate track incidents of hate, and the nonprofit noted in a report that from March 2020 to February 2021, Colorado ranked 13th in the country in discrimination or violence directed at Asian Americans and Pacific Islanders. Grants like this would allow us to upgrade a lot of the security features in our building to make sure that our staff are protected, said Harry Budisharta, executive director of the Asian Pacific Development Center. He hopes to get new security cameras. The current ones don't function well, and install panic buttons in offices in case of a mass shooting. Budisharta said the nonprofit center has received aggressive emails, many blaming the community for COVID-19, but they have not gotten direct threats to the center recently. Still, staff is in communication with law enforcement, and Budisharta wants to ensure community members can feel safe at the center. Representative Aman Jodha, an Aurora Democrat and Colorado's first Muslim woman elected to the State House, is also sponsoring the bill with Senator Kevin Priola, a Henderson Republican, and Senator Chris Hansen, a Denver Democrat. Jodha said the bill aims to decrease targeted crimes against religious communities that are often rooted in bigoted rhetoric. That's the same rhetoric that Imam Abdur Rahim Ali of the Northeast Denver Islamic Center worries has led to a rise in white supremacist behavior that could further affect houses of worship. He recalls two situations in the past couple of years at his mosque that highlighted the need for better security. In one instance, a man had been driving by the weekend school for kids at the mosque, put his hand out of the window and yelled, "Death to you all." And in another, a woman had entered the mosque when it was empty, broke the speakers, knocked over religious inscriptions off the wall, and trashed the prayer area. The security cameras weren't able to identify the people in either instance, and Ali hopes that with additional funding, the mosque can make some necessary upgrades. Although no one was hurt in either of these incidents, Ali doesn't want to wait for things to get worse. Colorado is, for the most part, a live-and-let-live state, Ali said. That's the type of environment that we live in Colorado. But when it's permeating all over the nation, it's going to affect us here in Colorado, too. So we don't want to be caught with our pants down when something happens. Dilpreet Jammu, Executive Director and President of Colorado 6, remembers the concerns about security for his community in blocks of time. After the 2012 Oak Creek shooting at a Sikh Gurdwara in Wisconsin, and after 9/11, and during Donald Trump's presidency, he worries even more about security after a Colorado 6 survey last year in which 75% of kids reported being bullied. That's part of the spectrum of targeted violence, whether it's against Sikhs, Jews, Muslims, or other groups, that gives a window into what's happening in society, he said. The bullying is something that builds. It is an indicator, and it's like our canary in the coal mine, Jammu said. It tells me something else is possible. The bill to protect institutions is about preventing and trying to mitigate the most severe forms of attacks and loss of life, he added. And Jammu sees it as necessary to protect all houses of worship, particularly those serving marginalized communities, because violence, which is showing up in one place, eventually spills over into other places. Other religious groups in Colorado have noted an uptick of incidents at their houses of worship. Archdiocese of Denver spokesperson Mark Haas said Catholic churches in the area have seen an uptick in vandalism, theft, and arson, with 30 incidents recorded from February 2020 to November 2021. The Colorado Catholic Conference has been part of the coalition working on the state legislation. Haas said these situations have created another opportunity for parishes to assess safety measures and improvements, something that's been a focus for the past 5 to 10 years after attacks on churches and synagogues, including in Pittsburgh, at the Emmanuel AME Church in 2015 in Charleston, South Carolina, and the First Baptist Church shooting in 2017 in Sutherland Springs, Texas. In Colorado, a gunman opened fire in 2007 at the Youth with a Mission Training Center in Arvada, and then the New Life Church in Colorado Springs. The legislation is also backed by at least 69 religious groups and nonprofits, including the Interfaith Alliance of Colorado and the Center on Colfax, an LGBTQ community center. This bill is necessary because, as we all saw with the recent hostage situation at Congregation Beth Israel Synagogue in Colleyville in Texas, faith communities are at increased risk of targeted ideological violence. The Biden administration even warned that faith communities will likely continue to be targeted by extremists in the future, said Shara Smith, Interfaith Alliance Executive Director, in a written statement. Regardless of what faith someone practices, everyone deserves to have safety and peace of mind when they're at their place of worship. In news briefs, former judge inducted into State Hall of Fame, Gary Jackson, a former senior judge in Denver County Court, was inducted Saturday into the Blacks in Colorado Hall of Fame. Jackson, who practiced as a lawyer for 43 years and who served as a county judge for 8 years until his retirement in 2020, is the seventh judge to be inducted into the hall. In 1970, Jackson became Colorado's only Black deputy district attorney within the Denver District Attorney's Office. A year later, Jackson was a Sam Carey Bar Association founder, helping to create a scholarship endowment for Black law students. Jackson in 2021 was inducted into the National Bar Association Fred Gray Hall of Fame, the second person inducted from Colorado. He also served as Assistant U.S. Attorney for Colorado. Zipporah Parks Hammond, the University of Colorado's first Black nursing school graduate, and the Reverend Leon Kelly, Executive Director of Open Door Youth Gang Alternatives, will join Jackson this month as inductees into the Hall of Fame. Denver area stations back on Dish Network after months-long absence. KUSA Channel 9 and KTVD Channel 20 are available once again for Dish Satellite TV subscribers. Tegna Incorporated, owner of the two Denver TV stations, announced Friday that it has reached a new carriage agreement with Dish, ending an absence dating to October. Two men charged in Thornton shooting death. Two defendants have been charged with murder in the December shooting death of a man in Thornton. Jonathan Garcia, 19, and Matthew McMahon, 18, are being held on suspicion of first-degree murder for the death of Fernando Perez, according to police. On December 3rd, Perez agreed to meet the pair regarding a clothing sale, police said. Perez was shot in the area of 101st Avenue and Clayton Street during a robbery. The suspects also face charges of second-degree murder, aggravated robbery, and conspiracy to commit aggravated robbery, the district attorney's office said. Woman killed in triple shooting at church in Aurora. A woman was shot dead in Aurora on Friday night in a triple shooting, and two men were taken to a hospital. The shooting took place at the Iglesia Faro de Luz Church in Aurora, 538 North Olathe Street in Aurora. The men are expected to survive, according to police. The shooter fled. Police said there was a relationship between the suspect and one of the victims. This is from Denver Post staff reports. Thank you for joining us for the Denver Post. My name is Diane Adler.